This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Just recently, an American teenager got off a plane in Paris and was shocked when she spotted a huge banner hanging in the airport. She shrieked, "That's my grandmother!" Her friends didn't believe her, but she was right. On that banner was a big photo of her grandmother, physicist Mildred Dresselhaus, because Dr. Dresselhaus had just won the annual L'Oréal UNESCO for Women in Science Award. That's a really big international prize that tries to make up for the fact that less than 2.5% of Nobel Prize winners have been women. In physics, women are most definitely in the minority, only 20% of the field. But in her long career, Dr. Dresselhaus has won all kinds of prestigious positions and prizes, and she usually has been the first woman to do so. She entered college expecting to be a school teacher, and then her physics professor helped change her mind. That professor was Rosalind Yalow, one of the very few women to win a Nobel Prize. Dr. Dresselhaus has repaid her mentor by supporting other women who want to be scientists. And she's become known as a visionary, someone who sees a huge potential in incredibly tiny stuff. Dr. Dresselhaus studies the nature of materials, especially materials made of carbon. In 1992, she laid the foundation of nanotechnology by predicting the existence of carbon nanotubes before anyone had actually seen these tiny but very strong structures for the first time. And then in 2003, the U.S. Department of Energy asked Dr. Dresselhaus to think about America's energy future. She chaired a panel to think about getting off our addiction to oil and decided that hydrogen was the way to go. Dr. Dresselhaus joins us this hour to give us her thoughts about our energy future and share with us what she's learned about science in the last half century that she's been practicing it. Dr. Mildred Dresselhaus is Institute Professor and Professor of Physics and Electrical Engineering at MIT, and she joins us today from Cambridge. If you'd like to talk to Dr. Dresselhaus, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Welcome to the program. Dr. Dresselhaus, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
I just have to ask, looking through your biography, I noticed that you were at the Cavendish Laboratory at Cambridge at the same time that Watson and Crick were there. Did you happen to meet them at all?
No, I didn't. In fact, when I was an undergraduate, I studied all kinds of topics. And upon graduation, I had an opportunity to be a Fulbright Fellow at Cambridge University. And I did two things there. One is I learned physics because that was going to become my future. But I also listened to many, many public lectures because Cambridge was the kind of place that had afternoon lectures that covered a gamut of topics. Mm-hmm. But molecular biology in its infancy was not one of the things I covered that time. needless to say, I didn't find out about the double helix until later on.
Well, you know, physics would not have been one of the things predicted by a woman studying in college to cover either.
That's true. That's true. When I was at the Cavendish in Cambridge University, there were maybe two or three times as many women as students there as they were in the comparable situation in the U.S. at that time. But I think that today it's maybe close to about the same.
Yeah, you see many more girls winning, you know, science prizes. The Intel science prize was won just this week by a girl again.
Yeah, well, that's kind of amazing because, now, years ago, that just didn't seem to happen very much. Mm-hmm. But young women today, they have expectations for careers in science that are very similar to those of men. So, you know, times have changed a lot since when mm-hmm. I started in the field.
Well, you started at a New York City public school system. It's a long way from Cavendish to
True.
New York City. How did you get started there?
Well, you know, the New York City public school system has two aspects. It has some of the very worst schools in the whole country, and it has some of the best schools in the whole country. And so if you start out in the worst schools, as I did, then you have some aspirations to try to make a transition to the best schools. And amazingly, that sort of thing has been possible in the U.S. It isn't quite so possible in other countries around the world. But the mobility and transition from starting in one place and winding up someplace very different is something that's part of our society.
Mm-hmm. Now, you started out thinking that you'd be a school teacher. And
That's right.
How did your path head to being a scientist?
Well, you know, when I started out as in a career, there were only three kinds of careers open to women at that time. At least that was what I was advised about when I was a student at the only a special high school in New York City for girls, and that was Hunter College High School. And even at that august institution that has graduated many leaders, female leaders in this country, we were advised at the time of my when I was going through the system that there were three opportunities for women. One was to be a school teacher. That was the one I chose. The other one is to be a secretary. And the third was to be a nurse. So it was not very deep pickings. Mm. And so that's what I did. And I, coming from a really good high school, when I started college at Hunter College, which was the natural place to go from Hunter High School, I did education kind of things, and I did science kind of things because I liked science. Mm-hmm. And I was well advanced at that time, so I could carry more courses than the average person. And so I was able to infiltrate various kinds of science and math education. And I, through the teachers that I had, and by the time I was well into my second year, it became clear that maybe I should make this transition. And
right.
As you introduced me, Rosalind Yellow was a big driving force in all of this. She was a very a domineering type person who told you what to do, and when you listened to her, you figured that she knew exactly what was the right course.
But she must have had confidence in you to remain your mentor.
Well, she remained my mentor for many years, actually, because she was that kind of person that had that kind of interest.
Yeah.
Now, for herself, she spent very, very little time in academia. She taught for a very short period of time, like 1 or maybe 2 years, and didn't have many, many students. I was one of the few lucky ones, and therefore she followed my career.
Mm-hmm. Having won the L'Oréal Prize for Women in Science, the L'Oréal UNESCO Prize, got that $100,000 that goes along with that. How are you going to spend it?
Yeah, well, you know, there are two. Whenever you get a prize that has substantial money, it makes you think a little bit. I mean, that's what happens to me, and I think it happens to normally other people. So half of it is to improve and extend my international scientific collaborations. I have research collaborators worldwide, and it's always difficult to find funds for them to visit and work with you, with me. So this will extend and enhance the scientific activity that I have with them, which has been a great source of inspiration and achievement mm-hmm. on my side. So that's what half the money is going to.
Mm-hmm.
And the collaborators are international ones because the prize is about international. And I have collaborators, very close collaborators, that I work with on essentially a daily basis from 4 different continents. So that's in concert with the goals of the L'Oréal UNESCO mm-hmm. Prize.
Mm-hmm.
The second thing is something that I haven't done before, and this is to do activities on behalf of women in science. In particular, probably women in physics, because I have the most knowledge base there. And but this time on an international basis.
Mm-hmm.
When I first came to MIT in the 1960s, my activities were first focused on women in science within my own institution, because when I came, we only had 4% of women in at MIT, period. And fewer even in physics. So that was really, really small numbers. And today we're getting close to the 50% mark And that's an amazing achievement in one lifetime. Of course, I didn't have that much to do with making it all happen.
Well, you had something. You're being overly modest about that. You had something to do with it, I'm sure.
I had something to do in the early days because I actually worked pretty intensively in changing things. Maybe the first 10 years, 20 years that when I came to MIT. But in recent times, I don't do so much of that because there are lots of other people that are involved. And so when I became president of the American Physical Society, which is the premier physics society worldwide, at that point I changed my emphasis and moved to thinking about women in physics for the whole country. Uh-huh. And I, because I was encouraged by my compatriots at the Physical Society, there were so few of us in physics at that time.
Right.
That was 1984, so that's over 20 years ago. And so we had an impact. You know, one person can have an impact on things like that. It's amazing.
Let me see if I can get a quick phone call in before the break. Lenore. No, she dropped out. We're going to take a short break and come back and talk with Dr. Dresselhaus. If you want to talk with her, our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. Are you speaking anywhere, Dr. Dresselhaus? People come in here, you'll speak in the next few weeks or so?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure to be speaking somewhere. I haven't really exactly. I usually give a talk on something or other every week. You know, publicly.
Yeah.
But I didn't bring my calendar along precisely.
And we can guess it would be about nanotechnology or hydrogen or something.
Yeah. It's the two topics that people ask me to speak on normally is something about nanotubes, science and technology more generally, or energy and our future.
All right,
those are the main topics nowadays.
Well, we're going to ask you to speak about them for us. So take a breath. We'll let you gather your thoughts. We're going to come back and talk lots more with you about nanotechnology and energy with Mildred Dresselhaus and your calls. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. We're talking with Dr. Mildred Dresselhaus, Institute Professor of Electrical Engineering and Physics at MIT. She has served as the President of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, Treasurer of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, President of the American Physical Society, and is currently Chair of the Governing Board of the American Institute of Physics. Of course, she's a member of the U.S. National Academy of Engineering. It's not easy to get membership in these clubs, let me tell you, as well as the Engineering Sciences section of the National Academy of Sciences. And I'm going to go on and on and on. It'll take the rest of the hour to fill it. Dr. Dresselhaus, tell us why you think hydrogen is the fuel of the future.
Well, actually, I wouldn't say that I think hydrogen is necessarily the fuel of the future. But rather what our report says is that hydrogen is a possibility of being a fuel for the future.
Mm-hmm.
That is, today we don't know enough either in the making, the production of hydrogen, the storage of hydrogen, or perfecting fuel cells and the utilization of hydrogen, say, and whatever kind of application we might think of, because the fuel cell has really been the driving force for the hydrogen, so-called hydrogen economy.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was asked to head up a national study by the Department of Energy, the question was, suppose we invested in hydrogen, the hydrogen economy, would that be a good investment? And so we had a team of about 125 individuals who were all gathered who had expertise in one aspect or another of this field, and we gathered together to discuss what is the possibility of hydrogen as an energy source of the future. And we came up with the conclusion that it was possible that this could be, but it doesn't say that this is necessarily the best technology for the future.
What would have to happen for that to occur, for hydrogen to become mainstream?
Well, let's take I know all three aspects, if you like. The production today is based on fossil fuels. Almost the entire worldwide production comes from that kind of route. and we would have to make this an important medium for transferring energy. That is, hydrogen doesn't occur in nature all by itself as an element that you can go in a mine or in a gas well and extract it. So it has to be produced. And the way it's produced today is from fossil fuels. Well, that's hardly renewable.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd have to find some kind of way to do this efficiently. In large quantity, because the world's demand for energy is so huge.
Mm-hmm.
So this would be a multiplication of the amount of hydrogen we produce by many, many times, you know, order of magnitude,
mm-hmm.
more than one order of magnitude.
Yeah.
So we're talking about big-scale stuff. Now, the second is the storage of hydrogen. We really don't have mechanisms now to store energy, period, in the kind of quantities that we would like, except through the liquid fuels that nature has supplied. For example, gasoline and other methane,
mm-hmm.
natural gas. Those kinds of chemical species are wonderful storage agencies of energy. But, of course, the release of these involves the release of carbon as well.
Right.
So, and that is not exactly what we want to do. That people that study what is the major energy issue, it has two components. One is energy security going into 100 years into the future, you know, hundreds of years, like forever into the future,
mm-hmm.
as long as we have the sun there.
Mm-hmm.
That is a natural conduit and source of as much energy as we need many times over. But we have to figure out some way to do this conversion in an efficient way. And
couldn't we use?
Don't know how to do it.
Couldn't we take wind power?
Yeah, power right now is a source of about 5% of energy. It's not a huge amount. And you know, people say that one technique does have potential, at least in the U.S. I'm not totally sure that it would supply the total world, but in the U.S., it has a great potential for a big expansion.
Mm-hmm.
To do this economically, you know, we don't yet know how to do that,
mm-hmm.
but and in the quantity, because it would have to be scaled up by, you know, mm-hmm. factors of more than order of magnitude.
Well, I have you for the last few minutes. Let's talk about nanotechnology.
Nanotechnology.
It going to be in everything? Are they going to find these nanotubes everywhere?
Well, I don't know if you'll find nanotubes everywhere, but you're going to find nano things in many, many things. That is, the world 50 years from now is going to be very different from the world is today, and nano is going to play a big role in that.
Are you concerned?
Ask me why, maybe.
Well, let me ask you some other. I'll get to that. But if nano is going to be everywhere, are you concerned at all that everywhere could also mean in our bodies, and that we don't know what the long term effects of all these nanoparticles may be?
Well, you know,
running around in our
one
bodies.
Of the responsibilities of the science community is whenever they are studying particular aspects of nano, they should also be studying the biological and human effects of the materials that they're making on us and on the environment. And at least in the fields of nano that I work on, and say on nanotubes,
right.
for example, that's a large part of the field. We have international conferences that gather 1,000 people or so to them. One of the topics that we do talk about every year now is the health effects.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for it is that we're concerned about the people ourselves, the researchers, you know, what conditions we should be working under and how safe are these conditions. And so far, so good. And then we're also worried about any products that are made. What is the effect on people?
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. is, I would say, American in attitude toward new materials and foods and clothing and all that, we're pretty imaginative, and we're willing to try many, many things, but not all of the world. Some parts of the world are a lot more conservative, and when you're in Europe, you'll find that people are much more concerned and conservative. They don't want to try anything until it's been thoroughly researched in terms of its human safety. Whereas the Americans are willing to do research under controlled conditions so that the individuals involved are safely taken care of, but research moves on. Mm-hmm. And we're used to that, and I think it's paid off quite well. Mm-hmm. We tend not to be alarmists about these kinds of things as in other parts of the world.
Do you think we're going to see a space elevator made out of nanotubes?
Yeah. Well, that's something that people fantasize about. I don't I have great hopes for that. But, you know, on the other hand, nanotubes and carbon materials have great strength, and they have stiffness. In fact, the mechanical properties are such that without them, we wouldn't have a space program. Mm-hmm. That is, the strength and stiffness of carbon fibers, which initially supported the space program, are absolutely essential for the spacecraft to have this strength to weight factor. And the nanotubes are even better in this regard. They have mm-hmm. additional resiliency and elasticity properties as well as the strength. So they're very desirable, and people are now using them. This is one of the larger commercial parts of nano today, is mixing nanotubes with polymers to do two things: to strengthen them and change or control their electrical properties.
Dr. Dresselhaus, I want to thank you for taking time to be with us. It goes by quickly, the time, doesn't it?
It sure does.
And good luck to you, and hopefully we'll check up and see what's happening with you later. Mildred Dresselhaus is an institute professor of electrical engineering and physics at MIT, and thank you for taking time to be with us, and good luck to you, and have a good weekend.
Thank you.